During the week, we had an important visitor from America in Kalgoorlie, Eugene Guccione. The mayor and councillors of Kalgoorlie invited him to be their guest of honour at a special luncheon in the mayor's parlour on Friday. In 1972, Eugene Guccione predicted with amazing accuracy the US energy crisis that emerged in 1974-75. He also predicted why it would happen. Since the accuracy of these predictions, he's become a frontline spokesman on energy, economic and environmental issues. In 1976 in Wyoming, Eugene Guccione shared the podium with Dr. Edward Teller, the father of the H-bomb, and the pioneer of nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. His visit to Australia was arranged by the Foundation for Economic Education Australia. With good humour and remorseless logic, Mr. Guccione stresses the absolute desirability of separating politics from all aspects of pure and applied science, including economics and mining. Mr. Guccione has witnessed the latest move by the federal government to remove the tax exemptions on gold mining.
At the local level, well, of course, this is bad news for the gold mining companies in the Kalgoorlie area. But you have to place this bit of news within the wider context of what is happening to gold, to the price of gold, in the international arena. The price of gold has been going down for approximately 1 year. Now, why is the price of gold been going down? The primary reason is that those people who want to buy gold want to have the lowest possible price for gold. Now,
so it's an artificial price at the moment?
It is an artificial price. It is being artificially depressed for two reasons. The first reason are the sale of gold by the International Monetary Fund. Another reason why the price of gold is down is because all governments, the United States government, the German government, the Italian government, the French government, want to buy gold. So they have to buy gold at the lowest possible price to reinstitute a new version of the Bretton Woods Agreement of 1944, whereby gold is the anchor for the international monetary system. To do that, they have to get as much gold as they can into their hands. They cannot leak that information to the public, and therefore they are going through this charade of pushing down the price of gold, scaring the suckers, people who are holding gold, into dumping gold into the market. So once the various governments have gold into their vaults once again, then they will realign their currencies according to their desires.
How long do you think this depressed state of the price of gold is likely to continue?
That is something that nobody can tell you. I can tell you that I have the certainty. I am certain that the price of gold will go up. There is no way out of it, because in a period of inflation, the price of any commodity goes up. However, gold is not simply any ordinary commodity. It's a very, very special commodity. It is a monetary standard. So while I have the certainty that the price of gold will go up, I cannot predict when it will occur.
In the meantime, what happens to a gold mining industry such as the one here in Kalgoorlie?
They will suffer. They will suffer. Well, they are already suffering. For the past year, the price of gold has been going down, thereby making it more and more uneconomical to mine gold.
Do you believe that they should hold on?
Oh, definitely. You don't give up on gold mining. If there is one lesson that we have learned from 5,000 years of monetary history, is that there is no substitute for the monetary role of gold.
What do you think the Australian government should do to help the gold mining industry at this time?
Well, not to interfere at all with gold mining activities, to rescind the 1973 foreign investment guideline policy that was introduced by the Whitlam administration, because that is predicated on a 50% Australian equity, And unfortunately, the equity market in Australia is very, very thin, and at a time of a worldwide monetary shortage, it's very difficult to raise capital in Australia. So by removing the foreign investment limitations on imported capital into Australia, this would considerably help the flow of foreign capital into Australia and presumably the opening up of new gold mines in Australia.
Would you like to give a personal prediction yourself? When can you see the whole industry coming together and getting on its feet again?
When the division of labor is understood by the Australian citizens as well as by the citizens of other civilized nations. What I mean by the division of labor is that government should do what government is best equipped to do, which is to run the local police, the criminal courts of law, the civil courts of law, and the military. Everything else government should get out of.
I asked Mr. Piccioni to comment on Australia's uranium policy.
Australia has the largest known reserves of uranium, so uranium is enormously important to the future of Australia, particularly in a world that has a shortage of energy. Now, it has been said that Australia should, in effect, sit on its uranium resources and not develop them until the proper time arrives. I think that is a short-sighted policy. You can always mine uranium, convert it into uranium oxide, yellow cake, which is chemically very stable, and then at the proper moment you can use it in nuclear reactors or whatever. However, there are a number of nuclear physicists in the Australian Workers' Union, in the FEDU, in the ANWU, the ETU, etc., etc., who are opposed even to the very mining of uranium, which is quite safe, quite harmless. It would bring foreign exchange to Australia. That would be very beneficial to Australia. Now, this does not mean that I think that nuclear energy is economical or anything of the sort, but I think that in the interest of Australia, Australia would be well advised to start mining uranium and converting it to yellow cake.
What about opposition in America from Union to mining uranium there?
I am not aware of any oppositions by unions in America to uranium mining, at least not direct oppositions, because, you see, socialism or communism in America is still a dirty word. Socialism in Australia is not a dirty word, so it is conceivable that labor unions, for political reasons that go above and beyond their legitimate role of protecting their members' interests, are now getting our lock, sack, and barrel in the political arena. And quite frankly, they are involved in a disastrous political type of activity, disastrous for the best interests of Australia.
And should Australia get on with mining uranium now?
That decision should be left entirely to the discretion of the market, of the Australian market, which consists of the 14 million inhabitants of Australia.
Mr. Eugene Guccione, thank you.
Identification interview with Gene Guccione, item about 5 seconds, end of item. Gene, what problems can you foresee in the Australian mining industry, the sort of problems that are currently before the American mining industry? What sort of problems do you foresee in this country as opposed to what's going on there at the moment?
Well, it will be an extension and a continuation transplanted in Australia of the same problems that the American mining industry has been suffering at least since 1969. Essentially, what we might see in Australia will be the problem of land withdrawals. In the United States, for example,
two-thirds of the federal land, publicly owned land, so-called, has been withdrawn from exploration activities. This goes against the 1872 mining law that was passed in Congress. This is analogous to a government telling the physicians of a country that henceforth two-thirds of the human body is barred from medical research. That's one problem. Then there are several other problems, but we can get to them as we go along.
All right, so you're suggesting, in fact, that Australia might face the same sort of problem with the governments withholding exploration permits. How, in fact, can mining companies combat that?
Well, first of all, how mining companies should not combat that would be by getting rid of the old-fashioned policy that somehow our problems can be cured if we appoint one of our old mine executives to a key government position. This is what American industry has tried to do for many decades, and that doesn't work. Another approach that does not work is the massive, expensive public relations campaign to educate the public. You cannot educate the public. You are the public. When you buy a suit, do you really give a damn about the problems of the textile industry? You don't. All you care about is whether you look good in a particular suit and whether you can afford it. Now, when the average member of the public is exposed to all sorts of propaganda, let's say, from this industry group, from that industry group, and so on, the public does not care and cannot care except in periods of extreme emergency when, let's say, the lights go off in an entire region and they stay off for a week. Then you're going to have a popular uprising, and then the public does care about what goes wrong in a particular industry. But until that time comes, the two traditional avenues of approach to solve mining problems will simply not work. What I am trying to propose is to utilize the same tactic that has been used so successfully already by the labor unions and by the entire group of ecologists and environmentalists. In other words, to get as many people as possible from within the mining industry itself. And I'm not talking about executives or managerial people. I'm talking about people at the middle level management and lower level management on their own to study a particular problem that they are faced with, to study in depth, and then on their own again to get in touch, either verbally or in writing, with representatives at the state level and at the federal level, and simply state the facts. And what I tell people in the mining industry, my own colleagues, is when you approach government, for heaven's sakes, don't ask for any favors. Don't ask for subsidies. Don't ask for handouts. Don't ask for protective tariffs, because you might get those things. But what it will mean in the end is that every other Australian, every other American will pay for those kinds of favor. And moreover, the fact is that in the mining industry, I'm talking now about the American mining industry, we don't need any favors from government. All we need is a little freedom to produce, to explore, and to trade.
But of course, in Australia, the government has set foreign investment guidelines which stipulate that Australian equity should be of the order of 50%. Now, how do you combat that, for example? Is that a realistic policy?
Well, once the Australian public, and I presume I'm talking to the public right now, realizes the utter insanity of that particular policy, they will put pressure on people in government, because every dollar of foreign investment that is cash raised abroad is invested in Australia simply because of the phenomenon of credit expansion. Credit expansion is a reciprocal function of reserve requirements, and reserve requirements in Australia are roughly 20%, meaning for every $100 that you put in the bank, $80 can be loaned out and $20 are kept in reserve. When the entire cycle of loans and deposits is finished, every dollar of deposit, every dollar invested in Australia will generate at least $5 of credit. Now, when that $1 of foreign investment goes into an industry as basic as the mining industry, then the multiplying effect is not 5, it is much greater than 5. It could be as high as 20, meaning every American dollar invested in Australia might lead to the production and creation of $20 Australian of wealth locally in the hands of Australian people.
But you've talked about this policy, foreign investment guidelines, being insanity, but in fact, as far as uranium is concerned, the percentage is 75%. Now, what do you think about that?
Well, that is an even worse case. I can understand why, for national security reasons, a short-sighted government would insist on 75% representation on the board of directors of a particular foreign company that is engaged in uranium mining, that is. But you see, when it comes to uranium mining, it is very, very similar to any other type of hard rock mining. There is no security problem at all, whatever, in mining uranium and then in processing the uranium that you get in the ground into uranium oxide, into yellowcake, that can be stored away. Now, the problem of storage and the problem of the issue of further enriching the yellowcake that you produced for marketing with nuclear companies in the electrical utility business, that might become a national security issue. Might or might not, I don't know. But certainly, in the mining cycle of uranium, that is not a national security issue. And that decision as to whether or not the Australian mining industry should or should not mine uranium should be left to the market for energy in Australia. In other words, what I'm saying is that that decision should be left to the 14 million Australians that constitute the Australian market and who, by their daily decision in buying and selling, as reflected in the price mechanism, have already signaled and have already told their decision to uranium producers whether or not uranium should be mined.
It's been suggested that mining in America is at crisis point. If mining companies in this country do not become active lobbyists, as you suggested, how long before the American crisis comes to this country?
Well, Pat, I'm not suggesting that Australian mining companies become lobbyists. I'm merely suggesting individual involvement. All right, if that does not happen, what is going to occur is that labor unions, and here in Australia I understand some labor unions are communist-controlled and socialist-controlled, you will see an intensification of their activities to the point where the unions will have much more to say than they do today into who mines what, where, and when. They can cooperate or conspire, let's say, or collude with similar unions in Japan and in other trading partners of Australia. And then you really have a situation that is completely out of the hands of both the federal government, the elected representatives of the Australian people, and of the people who are, in fact, the producers, that is, the mining people.
So, in fact, it could come to that situation, do you think?
Well, to some extent, that has already occurred. I understand that the unions decide whether or not uranium mining is going to occur. They decide whether uranium ore is going to be shipped to Japan or not. They decide even the nationality of the cargo vessels in which a particular uranium ore is going to be shipped. Isn't that the case?
Mm-hmm.
So there you have it. So you will see more of this, not only with uranium, but later on when iron ore shipments assume a more important role than they've had so far, then you might have some unions say, well, we don't like Indonesia, for instance, and therefore we should not send iron ore to Indonesia, or we don't like those greedy capitalist bastards in America, and therefore we should not export our iron ore in America, and so on, so forth and so on.
But do you think that these individual lobbyists from within the mining companies can in fact stem that tide? Is it really possible?
Yes, when it comes to the action of individuals. Look, any kind of revolutionary movement, any kind of a new idea, is always triggered by a very, very small minority. In the United States, for instance, there was a very, very huge power plant, a 5,000 megawatt power plant that was going to be built in Utah. The governor of the state wanted it. 92% of the population polled in Utah wanted that particular plant. The Mormon Church, very powerful in Utah, wanted that plant. The two senators from Utah wanted that plant. The two congressional representatives also wanted that plant. Everybody wanted it. A small minority of self-anointed ecologists decided that particular plant was not going to be built, and it wasn't built. The fight went on for 12 years, and ultimately that minority won the day. So, if we have a small vocal minority of intelligent people in the mining industry who do their homework, who study the issue, and point out to their elected representatives and to some of their friends in other industries exactly what would be the consequences, the pros and cons of doing or not doing a particular thing, then this is really all that you have to do.
So on a slightly different subject here, let's say for anyone of a libertarian or free market temperament, what do you see as the good signs in particular in the USA and in Australia, the signs by which we should be encouraged?
Well, for one thing, as far as the universities are concerned, in the United States, there are relatively few economists who are willing to identify themselves with Keynesian so-called economic policy. If nothing else, a lot of American scholars are still pragmatists in the sense, not in the philosophical sense, but in the common sense way of the word. They realize that Keynesian economics simply hasn't worked, that it's turned out to be a disaster. It creates inflation, which ultimately leads to more and more unemployment. The Phillips curve, for instance, that shows that concomitant variation between increasing inflation and decreasing unemployment, those curves work only at the initial stage of the inflationary spiral. But as inflation continues, what happens is that marginal firms who are unable to catch up in their price increases, especially when you have such a thing as a tribunal price justification board or some damn thing like that, well, they're way behind, and the marginal producers are the first ones to go bankrupt, to go out of business, so that increases unemployment. And, of course, as the cost push of inflation gets worse and worse, then other producers eventually get victimized. So more unemployment results. At this particular point, the unions go on the war path, and they start asking for more deficit spending to stimulate the economy. But the point is that more deficit spending to stimulate the economy, that type of a program is not directed by the cumulative decision of all the millions of people who are the determinants in that market. In other words, since they haven't been voting with their dollar, those will not be a kept signal to producers, according to the price mechanism, of what they should produce and how much they should be producing to meet a particular market demand. Sure, everybody knows that there is a demand for job, but where is the demand for goods? So the best thing when it comes to inflation is not to start in the first place. And that is a problem at the federal level. Okay. Going back to the states, best signal is Keynesian economics is on the wane. Fewer and fewer big name economists want to identify themselves with Keynesian economics. At the political level, and this is something for which libertarians should take credit, the two biggest political parties in the country, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, are both running on what is in effect an anti-big government platform. I don't know how much of what they say is simply election time rhetoric and how much of it is based on principles, on a true understanding of the free market economy, on the immense liberating effect that a little economic freedom would have in boosting the wealth-producing capacity of the nation. But the fact is that there's been an immense change in the past 5 or 6 years. So that's a good sign in itself, even though a lot of the politicians who talk against big government and who complain about the great amount of overregulation, we didn't have that years ago. We do have it today. Well, when it comes to the political aspects of the Libertarian Party itself, it's surprising that a party that only was started 4 years ago is will probably be this year on the ballot of about 40 different states in America. And getting on the ballot in America for a new party is not an easy trick to pull.
And how many years has it taken for the Libertarian Party to come this far, Jim?
4 years.
Four.
It was formed officially, the National Party was formed officially in 1972. And since then, we've managed to get on the ballot in 40 different states. Now, what's going to happen in November, I have no way of knowing. I think that a good showing would be about 3%. I mean, if the Libertarian Party gets 3% of the vote, that would make an awful lot of people take notice of the Libertarian Party. But regardless of what happens this year, I don't think that going our own way, our separate way, as a party, would necessarily be of ultimate benefit to the country. The idea is this, and this is something that most of us have thought about. We really don't want to get involved with politics. We are using the political arena as a shortcut for diffusing our principles in the field of morality, in the field of sound economics, in the field of everyday politics. We're trying to educate the voters, in effect. So, as a political branch, we are able to do that. This is how we get the attention of the press, the attention of the media. This is how we get on television.
Most libertarians are really non-politicians, aren't
Most
they?
Most libertarians are non-politicians. It's the kind of activity that turns them off. Because once you get involved in the political process, politics being what it is, you have to compromise, you have to bend backwards, with some of your own principles, and this is something that none of us is really willing to do. However, working in the political arena, this is one way of educating the greatest number of people in the shortest amount of time. Not educating them, but at least stimulating them, planting some seeds, creating some activists, keeping up the interest and curiosity and alertness within the members of the Libertarian Party so that their enthusiasm doesn't die off and they remain active. And what I've told a lot of libertarians is try to become active within your own industry group. Work at the grassroots. Work with what you know best. Try to think of the problems in your own industry that have been caused by a particular type of government regulation. Examine it in detail. Trace the cause and effect consequences of that particular law in your industry. And then come up with a plan for either castrating that particular law or perhaps a bolder plan to repeal that law. In other words, come up with a libertarian solution to it. Ultimately, if we persist in that, what will happen is that both the major political parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, having pressures both directly from the media at the grassroots level, from all sorts of very, very articulate activists, what they will do will be to steal our platform away from us. This is exactly the same tactic that was used by Norman Thomas in America, who was the head of the American Socialist Party, to the point that over a period of two generations, over a period of 50 years, the Democratic Party today incorporates all of the things that Norman Thomas advocated. So if Norman Thomas could do it, we can do it too.
That's one way for individuals to at least stop things from getting any worse than they are right now. And if enough of them can do it, it can in fact sort of turn the ship around and steer it back in the free enterprise direction. What can people in middle management do along the same lines?
People in middle management. Well, what they have to do in the first place is to study, to prepare themselves to do their homework, never to speak in public unless they've first done their homework and they know precisely what it is that they're talking about. Again, for instance, you have in Australia this problem with having to file an environmental impact statement. That always puts industry in the position of having to prove a negative, because in effect what the environmental impact statement asks of you is prove that your future activity will not damage the environment. Birds and so forth and so on. That doesn't make sense. Merely citing this as an example. But problems that they might have with a particular militant union. For instance, a union that refuses to ship a mineral concentrate in bottoms other than Australian bottoms. Well, this is something where management person, speaking of as an individual, could put pressure to bear on this union and say, look, I'm not against you when you as a labor leader are trying to increase the benefits for your own members, because this is what you're supposed to do. We all want more money for ourselves, more vacation for ourselves, more fringe benefits, more holidays and so on. And this is the only job that a union should do. When a union leader steps goes beyond that task and starts posing as a statesman, then he introduces distortions in the economy on a national scale. I can't be more specific than that. I don't know what the particular problems of the various managers are. But middle management people, lower management people, again, speaking as individuals, leaving the name of the company out of the picture, can do quite a lot of good for themselves, their own industry, their own country. This is, again, the same kind of technique that was used very successfully many years ago by labor unions. There is nothing wrong in talking with your own people, contrary to what you hear at meetings of the Society of Mining Engineers in America, the Australasian Institute of Mining and Metallurgy, that what's the sense of preaching to the converted? We are only talking to ourselves. I think that is the wrong attitude, because after all, who the hell is going to save the mining industry except the mining industry itself? No one helped labor unions in the beginning when they were trying to get somewhere. In fact, they had the media against them, they had business against them, the churches in the latter part of the 19th century were also against labor unions. And the fact is that labor unions didn't scratch their heads and ponder, well, what are we going to do? We're only talking to ourselves. Well, they talked among themselves. They organized. They formed cells. They organized their own speakers. And gradually, their message eventually spread on the outside. There is no substitute for individual action. Because when it comes to an idea, with an idea, if an idea is right, the worth of an idea does not depend on the number of the people who adhere to it or who are against it. An idea is either right or wrong. So if an individual has done his own work and knows precisely what the problem is and comes up with a solution, then he will get attention.
In recruiting as many activists as possible from the mining industry, it just has appeared from our trip around that these people are best recruited from middle management, mm-hmm. because the top management people are just absolutely terrified to go to air.
Well, perhaps if they're not terrified, they think that it might take too long, that they don't have enough time for it, that they have other problems to worry about, that this whole approach is too theoretical and not practical enough. But the thing is that you have to start somewhere, obviously, since you cannot start with the mining leaders. Start working with the middle management people, because after all of the things that I hear are not from the top management people. I seldom get in touch with them, except once in a while when I want an article or a special editorial. I talk with the middle management level guys who are as frustrated as you and I are. Well, those are the people where you find that you find are most receptive to this particular approach, and the idea is to just plant a seed into their own minds, hope that it takes, and then have them do the work on their own. So even if, in the course of a month, by talking once or twice a month, we have been able to bring one person to your point of view, in effect, you have doubled your ability. And if you get two guys, you have tripled your activity in terms of It works like a pyramid, you know, one guy that influences another guy influences another guy, and before you know it, you have a spreading chain. This is what I see happening in the United States. And best of all, it's we have had most of our success with young people. Mm-hmm. Young people who are fed up with all of the obstructions that are put in their path. And what you try to do is... instead of making a frontal attack with your opponents, even your opponents will share some common ground with you. For instance, people in the media, in newspapers, usually care very much about freedom of speech. Well, if you can get them to agree to share a particular premise of yours, namely, for instance, the fact that you cannot have the freedom of speech without the right to own a printing press, a building, ink, paper, that sort of thing. Once they agree to that, that's a very, very powerful thing that you have put into their heads. In other words, that freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion cannot exist without property rights. And then the next step is to make that premise wider and say that no human right can exist without property rights.
Mm.
And this is the same approach, for instance, that a manager should use with labor people, because you see, labor people have been victimized by the socialist ideology. Most labor leaders don't understand how wealth is created. They have been brainwashed, or to the extent that they have, that they have not been brainwashed, they have been terribly confused by the propaganda from the socialist camp, from the collectivist camp. And if you want to, I can trace quickly why this ignorance of how wealth is produced came about. Do you want me to talk about that?
Yeah, because that might help us in explaining why, although free enterprise is seen by you and I to be the best and most effective economic system, the thing that always has me probably has me puzzled is that why can't we sell the enthusiasm? Why can't we get others to be enthusiastic about the free enterprise system? And this may what you throw in may just explain, turn some keys in some doors.
Okay, Ron, the human race is very, very young. Of rocks that are about 2 billion years old or something like that, or 10 billion years old. Well, when it comes to man's record on this planet, it only goes as far back as about 6,000, maybe 6,000 years ago. Actually, the documented record doesn't go any further back than 4,000 years ago. I'm talking about the Bible.
Mm.
So the human race is very young, broadly speaking. Okay. If you read history, up until the time of the Industrial Revolution, which also coincided with the American Revolution, which was, to my way of thinking, the only revolution that ever took place in this planet. All the others were merely a changing of the guard. Anyway, up until the time of the Industrial Revolution and of the American Revolution, wealth was accumulated by means of military conquest, whip-offs, usually by the great lord, by rip-offs, by theft, by debauching the currency, usually by metallic adulteration, shoving in copper and brass into gold and eventually winding up with copper coins and so on. And also by physical labor, which meant, in 9 cases out of 10, by slave labor. The Industrial Revolution changed all that, because for the first time in the history of mankind, a human being could harness the power of steam so as to produce work. So you were no longer physically limited to how powerful your muscles were. You had the mechanical extension in the steam engine of the power of your mind. And then by hooking it up to textile factories and so on, productivity increased, sort of doubled or tripled every 5 or 10 years. Okay. So the lesson was that wealth could now be obtained by creative ability, by productive ability, and by the use of machinery that liberated men from
parameters of just his own body. Now, the mind became very, very important because intelligence paid off, knowledge paid off. So, unfortunately, what happened at the time was that all of the thinkers of that period, all of the 18th century thinkers in Europe, did not realize the importance of the Industrial Revolution. They did not become aware of the impact that the American Revolution was having. And you cannot blame the thinkers of the 18th century for their failure to recognize what was going on. After all, communications were not then what they were today. So the only thing that they did was they realized that more wealth was being circulating around, more wealth than ever before, but they were unable to understand where it came from or how it was being generated. They merely looked, observed their own particular systems of government, which were just a variation of a feudalistic totalitarian system of government. Then they also looked back in history, and they found that really all the various governments, all the various societies were organized on slavery. Were all different versions of totalitarian regimes in which a society was divided artificially into exploiters and exploited, into the haves and the have-nots, in the blessed and the damned, in the word of St. Augustine. So, they said that to cure the inequities, what was needed now was a massive redistribution of wealth. About two generations later, in the middle of the 19th century, around 1850, I believe it was, that idea was popularized by Karl Marx, who saw everything in terms of economics, in terms of power, the established elite, and the working classes. And he saw everything within the context of a class struggle, a class warfare of the proletariat against the state, or against the vested interests. So he came up with big system whereby there would be a struggle between the proletariat and the aristocrats, and this also fitted in with its own particular hang-up with Hegelian philosophy that saw everything in terms of a thesis and an antithesis, and then out of this fight between the thesis and antithesis, there would be a new synthesis. The new synthesis in the case of Karl Marx was the classless society. The state would vanish away, and that everybody would live in some sort of Marxist paradise. Now, since Karl Marx observed everything in collectivistic terms, he never took the role of the individual into account. What happens is that once you have a movement that has all the best intentions in the world and tries to do things for the benefit of the proletariat, or even for the common good, if you don't like that word proletariat, the fact is that there is no such thing as the public out there that you can point your finger to. The public is merely the sum total of every individual in a particular society, and this is something that our founding fathers knew. If you want to achieve the public good, you must first ask yourself, what is the good of the individual? And when it comes to that kind of a question, that is a question of morality. And morality always involves a choice. And morality is always something very, very personal. So, by protecting the rights of the individual to his own life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, the right to his own property, and otherwise leaving men free to pursue their own improvement, this led to the common good to an extent that it never before that have never been seen in history before. So, what's involved in the process of production? Well, take for instance this idea that a lot of mining people have about natural resources. They seem to think that once a natural resource, meaning a particular ore body, has been exhausted, that's the end of the cycle. You have to start looking for other resources. They're right in that. But they have a rather materialistic view of what wealth is. The root of wealth is the mind of man, is knowledge. That isn't enough, however. You've got to have some sort of a natural resource out there that you recognize as a resource. Then you have to apply your knowledge to the problem of production in order to convert that particular ore body into a marketable commodity. So what's involved in the process of production and the process of creating wealth is, first of all, you have to have people who know, who have the knowledge. They also, well, for instance, the example I usually give is that of the surgeon. Okay, what is his particular resource? Well, it's of course the knowledge that he acquired in medical school and the skill that he has in his hands. He didn't get this ability overnight. It took him several years. So the fact is that at the end of his training, this particular resource that he has in his mind and in his hands will be totally worthless and useless to him and to anybody else unless he puts it to work. Then after it starts working, this is when the benefit will accrue to himself and to his fellow men. In this sense, there is no such thing as a natural resource. All of the rocks and the dirt and the underground matter that you find, all of those things are totally useless and valueless until somebody with the knowledge comes in, is willing to work, and starts producing values. And in the problem of production, the questions that you're always faced with ultimately boil down to either or type of propositions. Is it right or is it wrong? Is this true or is it false? Is it real or is it unreal? Is it valid or is it just my wishful thinking? So these are really ethical questions. So whoever the producer happens to be, he has to have the honesty to ask those kinds of questions, to phrase those questions in that form. And then, after he has found the answer and proved that the answer is correct, he has to have the integrity to put that answer into effect, to execute it. So what's involved in the process of production, to summarize it, is knowledge, reason, logic, honesty, and integrity. I mean, it's the best in a man that's involved in the process of production. So, we, the producers, are being accused of being materialists. But we're not materialists, because you and I know precisely how little that stuff in the ground is worth until we start making something out of it.
Sure.
Now, we are being called materialists by the type of people who are experts at a different type of materialism. That's the dialectical materialism, which is the stuff that comes out from all of the spiritual descendants of Karl Marx, the socialists, in effect. They are the dialectical materialists. To them, the process of wealth creation is a big, big mystery, to the extent that they ever think about it. They usually say that wealth is created by the worker. That's nonsense, because if wealth were created by the worker, all that you would have to do is to look at those countries that have the greatest number of workers. India, China, those are not rich countries.
Mm-hmm.
So It's just wealth depends on the individual and on how free he is to do what he wants with his own resources, with his own intellectual resources.
So,
the best thing is to aim your pitch at the people who are the producers in your community. Even though they might have entirely different political views than your own, the best thing to do is never to make a frontal attack, never to say, well, I believe that so-and-so is the case. Start by asking the man, for example, your opponent, let's say, what are some of the problems that he has in his own business? And then you tell him on your own what are the problems that you have in your own business, sort of swap notes. And then as you draw the man out, to the extent that he has any acumen at all, he will realize that quite a number of problems in his area, in his work, stem from some sort of goddamn law, either at the state level or at the federal level. Could be that some of the problems are due to competition. Well, in that particular case, you tell him, you try to find out from him whether this competition, or rather the uncompetitive place in which he has been put, was caused by unearned favors that his competitors obtained from the state, or whether his lack of competitive savvy is due to his own incompetence, or not necessarily incompetence, or whether he isn't quite as smart as the other fellow. So if the other fellow is smarter than he is, or even if he works harder than he does, you tell him, look, this is a fact of life. And if your other guy is better than you at doing a certain job, well, you can do the same thing. Or if you cannot do the same thing, then what's the sense of your wasting all this time and energy hitting your head, so to speak, against a stone wall? Why don't you go and work for him? Learn from him as much as you can. Then after you have learned, then you can go somewhere else and set up shop for yourself. You'll have a brand new market, and you can make a success of yourself. So it's the idea of getting the other fellow to tell you what kind of problems he has, even if he has entirely different political ideas than you do. Once you know that, you already have a great deal of insight about the man that the man himself never had and doesn't have as yet. So these are the tools that you have to work with.
Mm.
And in the process of talking to a local businessman, you know precisely what are the problems that he's faced with. Then to the extent that you get involved in the inside workings of your own industry, the moment that you have to talk, let's say at some annual meeting of the Automobile Dealers Association in Western Australia, you will know precisely what's bugging them, and then you can work out the analysis. You can trace, well, this is when they introduced the tariff against imported cars, and this is what the tariff has done. This is how much, this is the income level for our customers in this particular area, and this is how much our automobiles are costing, and at these high prices, we cannot possibly sell all of our output. Let's see what we can do. Well, maybe we shouldn't have such high protective tariffs for Honda bicycles or for Volkswagen or that sort of thing. We should insist for a lower tariff. And then you can make the moral case against tariffs. And for that, you find your material in Ludwig von Mises. So even Adam Smith speaks very eloquently about that.
Mm.
So the other guys are going to listen to you. You talk the same language. You are aware of their problem, and before you know it, they'll be agreeing with you. And one manager says, so to speak, I'm using your name just as an example, then they will start following you. You are the leader. You are the recognized authority in your field.
Well, that's a good point. Rather than create this, I think the other people on the other side create enough divisiveness and enough conflict between the various groups of people, especially in Australia. Your idea is not to dissipate our energy on frontal attack, but just to take the thing from around the side, win them over one by one.
Yeah, work with people in your own industry first. Now, this is something that dentists should do, that physicians should do, talk to other physicians, for dentists to talk to other dentists, and so on. And when you talk to labor people, by all means, agree with them immediately that what you want is exactly the same thing that they want. What you want is more money, more vacation, more fringe benefits, and so on, but the point is, look, we got to make it first before we get it. And when it comes to making it, to make them understand that if they were working in an anti-capitalistic society, a typically anti-capitalist society would be India. All right. Why is the productivity of Indian labor so abysmally low? And this is because the amount of capital invested per Indian worker compared to the amount of capital invested per American worker, per Australian worker, is extremely low. In America, for instance, in the petroleum industry, each worker, on the average, in the petroleum industry, has an investment on him of about $50,000. So this is a good rule of thumb. But the thing is this, that and it has been proved for so many times in this century that I feel dumb even talking about it. But the thing is this, productivity is primarily a function of how much capital has been invested by managers per employee. By just pushing a button, for instance, at a computer, programming operator in the United States makes anywhere between $15,000 and $30,000 a year, depending on how sophisticated his job is. Now, he does that with virtually no physical labor at all. He just pushes a few buttons. And the main resource that he has is in his brain. And if you look at the hardware in terms of IBM computers and so on, that is there available at his disposal, that adds up into hundreds of thousands of dollars. Where did that money come from? That came from retained earnings, that came from profit, that came from the savings of individuals and corporations. And this is when you start telling people that capitalism is nothing else but your reinvestment of your own money into the machinery that is going to increase your productivity, and that will give you all the good things in life that you want and that I want.
Okay. So you've shown how all of us, all different sectors of the community, are really in this together, and we should be working together rather than against one another. I appreciate your comments. Thanks very much.